The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Folks, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the Israeli summer, the J14, the protests going on in Israel. Over 300,000 people came to the streets all across Israel in unprecedented protests in a nation of only 7 million people. And it has seemed to have brought right and left, and Palestinians and Israelis and secular and religious, all to protest for more social justice in Israel. The question is, where does this lead? What does this mean? Is this akin to the Arab Spring? Is this something bubbling up from under, from all over? And how could this really, may this dynamic change Israeli society at large and the Israeli-Palestinian society together at large? We're talking with Dimi Ryder, who you just heard, and Aziz Abu Saro, who both wrote an op-ed piece together in the New York Times, which is where we found them, and we will link to all their work on our website, steinershow.org. And Aziz, I wonder about, just taking off from that, what's the most significant thing for you as a Palestinian, as an Israeli, in this demonstration? What do you, from your perspective, what are you seeing?
I think for many years I worked going to as a lecturer, and I went to Israeli high schools, both Arab, Palestinian Israeli, and Jewish Israeli high schools, and talked to students and college students about how they can participate in life and in decision-making in Israel. What I often found is a strong indifference and apathy about the situation, where people felt politicians can make decisions and that's it. People can, you know, vote in Israel, often only on one issue, which is the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And social rights and the social structure of Israel was not a priority for people at all. But the indifference was one of the things that often disappointed me the most in talking to these youngsters and realizing they didn't really believe they can make any difference. So watching what's happening in Israel, to me, is, with all my reservations and criticisms, is very hopeful, and it's very encouraging to see people's willingness to come out in the street and be willing to show what they want and say we have demands and we expect it to be answered. That's something new and we haven't seen in Israel for a very long time. Also, to see Arabs welcomed into these protests, not just welcomed, to have an Arab speaking to the 300,000 protesters, that's a big, I think, a big move towards bringing the two communities together within Israel, and that's unprecedented in many ways. So to these things, there are many positive things, I think, about this protest that we have to keep in mind. There are many demands of the Arab community within Israel, the Palestinian community within Israel, that, you know, especially regarding how privatizing the public land. You know, in Israel, most land are public, and when they are public, it means Palestinians who are citizens of Israel are unable to buy this land and unable to use it, and it becomes only Jewish housing. And so for many Palestinian citizens of Israel, this is a main thing that they want to see change. And to be able to create a coalition within Israel with Israeli Jews about these issues is unprecedented and very important. And I'm hopeful that it will be successful.
Now, I wonder what you think. One of the things that Dimi wrote about in his piece that I just read this morning, Aziz, in terms of this protest of 300,000 people on the streets of Israel, across Israel, is that and he mentioned a little earlier in our conversation, is the fact that Palestinians who are part of Balad and Hadash, two left-wing organizations representing Palestinian poor and working-class people in Arab towns in Israel, seem to have crossed a line And there's this neighborhood that I'll describe to our listeners, Hatikva in Tel Aviv, which is a neighborhood where a lot of immigrants from Africa and other places are moving into, but it's also kind of a hotbed among Jewish Israelis of supporting kind of right-wing politics, have kind of crossed lines to come together saying we may have more in common, actually march together with Arab and Hebrew slogans together. I wonder what is the significance of that, and what does it give and say to you?
You know, politicians have done very well in the last few decades on separating the Palestinian Israelis from the Jewish Israelis in Israel and planting that fear thing where Arabs are against Jews and Muslims and Christians, and there's a strong separation that happened through the last years and decades where the two sides have got more and more afraid of each other. And I think finally this, to me, seeing the two sides coming together and saying, wait a second, what politicians have done basically is created a division among us in a way that divide and conquer. When they divided us as people, because Palestinians who are citizens of Israel are about 20% of the population. When you can isolate 20% of the population and make them unable to connect to the rest of the country, you're actually weakening the will of the people in general. And so seeing people coming together now and realizing that what happened to them in the last few years have been in many ways a political tactic that weakening them and hurting both Jewish Israelis and Palestinian Israelis is very helpful. And realizing that if we can work on this, then maybe we can work on many other issues in the future. Maybe we can actually coexist together, because in many ways, Israelis who are citizens of Israel, Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, understand that there's no other place they're going to go. They are part of the state. There's many things they're not happy about in the state of Israel, things that they want to change regarding equality, not feeling as second-class citizens, having more ownership of land. You know, poverty in the Palestinian side is normally, Palestinian citizens of Israel is much higher than poverty in other places. So all of that, yes, they want to make change, but I think they're realizing now also that we can make that difference by working together with also poor people who are Jewish Israelis, and there are many of those, instead of each one having his own battle. Unity between the two sides can actually win instead of having division between the two sides.
And let me ask you both this question. I'll start with Dimi. I mean, when you see, Dimi, and then go back to Aziz, when you see this kind of crossing of lines that you wrote about and Aziz was just commenting on, Israeli, Palestinian, poor, and kind of working class people coming together in these protests, allies you'd never thought would work together, let alone talk to each other. I wonder what that, as somebody who's been in this for a long time and in this struggle for against the occupation, also in the struggle for a more equitable Israel, what do you see in this? I mean, do you see a hope in this? Is this a flash in the pan, or is this something that might somehow sustain a movement and go beyond the divide in some ways we're not even contemplating at the moment?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm certainly hopeful for the latter scenario.
I guess you are.
Yeah,
we all are, I think. But
I mean, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's very, and the one kind of feature of that movement is that it's so intoxicating with hope. Because, you know, you go there, I try to visit at least one of the tent encampments every day, and you go there, and it's not only that it's still there, but it's growing, and it's developing, and the discourse is growing. And so far, the government is making every favorite mistake dealing with that, and it's only helping it to grow. So it's very hard not to get high on optimism. So, you know, I'm definitely hopeful that this is the beginning of something new. I know that there are also a lot of arguments between these new allies, and they were arguing as they marched, but they kept marching together as they argued. You know, I certainly hope that this will also come to include somehow the Palestinians beyond the Green Line. Although it's kind of right now, it's a bit difficult to imagine how it's going to happen. I think basically that the as I wrote in this piece you mentioned, the many separation lines between various kinds of Jewish Israelis, definitely Jews and Arabs, various separating lines within the Palestinian nation itself, are the major obstacle. This is like the grid system that supports many, many wrongs, including the occupation. So I hope that by kind of beginning to shake at some of these grids, these new allies will make a difference. But I see many challenges ahead. And one of the main challenge for that alliance will be, of course, September, when the Palestinians are going to seek recognition from the United Nations as an independent state, or at least as an observer state, because the U.S. is probably going to veto that in the U.N. Security Council. Now, this will put, as two activists named Elat Moz and Yasmin Bayer wrote on an Israeli website this morning, this would put the Palestinians within Israel in a very tight spot, because, you know, they're beginning to discover the potential of acting as part of this very Israeli coalition. And yet, here comes this call for nationhood. And September is probably going to be a flashpoint. We already have the government fear-mongering and talking about calling up the reserves. Many of the protesters in the tents are reserve soldiers who will have to decide whether to leave the tents and go into the territories and potentially suppress very similar demonstrations held by Palestinians. And the Palestinians within Israel will have to try and figure out how they will support the Palestinian bid for nationhood, and at the same time maintain the solidarity with their fellow Israelis. So that's one challenge that I don't yet know how the movement is going to overcome. But then, on the other hand, a month ago I had no idea anything like that will happen.
Right, exactly.
So I can only say that I'm very hopeful that it will overcome these obstacles and will keep growing and growing.
And Aziz, I guess at this moment, even though you're at the Institute at George Mason, some part of you wishes you were there in Israel right now.
Oh, I'm going back on Saturday, so I'll be there. I might actually be there for the protest on Saturday. I'll make it before the protest on Saturday. So I'm not staying away that long.
That's great.
But I'm very hopeful, and I'll tell you from my personal story. I grew up, until I was 18, I grew up in East Jerusalem, which there are no checkpoints between East and West Jerusalem. 200 meters away from my high school, there was a Jewish school. And I grew up in a place where I've never met really an Israeli and had a conversation with him until I was 18 years old. And that tells you a little bit about the kind of separation we're talking about. People talk about the physical wall between the West Bank and Israel that's been built. I talk about more the emotional world that's full of ignorance and fear and hatred and arrogance and all of these things that separate the two communities, even within Israel. You know, as we say, 20% of Israelis are Palestinians, and that division must end, because you can't work together until you realize we have a common goal. And I think in this issue, we have definitely. Palestinian Israelis have common goal with Israeli Jews, and they can get along a lot better than they thought if they have this goal clear. And now there's a clear goal, therefore they can be unified on it. And I think that's where, as Dimi said, it might be a little bit tricky as the West Bank issue come up. But the work that needs to be done that often had not been done is getting Israeli Jews to understand more and more about the effect of the occupation on their daily life. And I really believe many Israelis don't necessarily understand that, don't understand how the occupation, how much money is going there. $700 million a year going to sustain just the military operations in the West Bank. For a small country like Israel, 7 million people, that's a lot of money. Talking the occupation cost Israel in 40 years since 1967 to 2007, $50
billion.
That's quite a lot of money. So we have to communicate that, I think, to more Israelis. And if the poor people who are Jews within, you know, Shchonat HaTikva, the neighborhood HaTikva, or other neighborhoods within Israel, realize that, wait a second, for a settlement to be built, that's going to take away from what I can have, I think people are going to think a little bit harder about it. Some people might not care, but a lot of people do. And for Palestinians, who are citizens of Israel, to build on that, I think it would be smart, instead of saying, you know, moral issues are important and we have to go and say the occupation is wrong morally, but also financial things are important, and people care about what goes in and out of their own pockets as well. My worry personally is about what steps Netanyahu can take, and he has a few steps he can take that could change reality. One of it, which the defense minister Barak mentioned a couple of days ago, that, well, if there's any conflict, everybody who you see in the street is going to enlist in the army and they're going to forget about what's happening now. And Israel has many possibilities of having conflict at any moment, whether it's Gaza or Iran or Lebanon. And I think that could be one card that, unfortunately, Netanyahu could use if he feels this threatened. And there are a few other cards as well that he could use. I don't see him changing his policies on economics. Netanyahu has been one of the pioneers of making Israel more and more a capitalist country. He's been all for privatization. So I don't see him really, it's his project, it's his baby, and I don't see him really changing his opinion on that. I think it's more likely that his government either would fall or you'd see him using one of his trump cards to change reality rather than being willing to really listen to the demands of the protesters.
I'm sorry, Tim. We're about to conclude. You want to have a closing thought there?
I mean, I would just like to add on top of what Aziz was saying that I think that merely pointing out to Israelis the cost of the occupation will not necessarily do the trick. First of all, because they do perceive the settlers to be compatriots, and one of the strongest features of that movement so far was that it's all inclusionary language. So any kind of attempt to direct that at a particular group of people, whether directly or, you know, or saying that we should be spending less money on these people and more money on the rest of us, probably it's a risky step to take. But I think that the cost of the occupation should definitely be highlighted more. It is a huge, you know, black hole sucking up funds, money, lives from people on both sides of the green line. But also another thing that should be highlighted is, you know, breaking down the wrongs of the occupation beyond the grand historical conflict into the simple issues that Israelis can identify with. I mean, for instance, the housing. It's literally impossible to build legally in a Palestinian village in the West Bank. Many of them don't have proper roads. Many of them don't have running water. And walking along the boulevard, it's these issues that, I mean, the protest camp on the boulevard, it's these issues that I find people readily agreeing with. They might not be ready to talk about statehood and about national reconciliation, but they readily agree that people should have access to water. They readily agree that people should have the freedom to move between their communities without wasting hours and hours in checkpoints. So I think it should be a combination of what Aziz was pointing out, the really hard cold logic of the economic situation, and also trying to inspire solidarity through issues that everybody can understand anywhere.
I want to thank you both for the time you've given us today and given all of our listeners today. Demi Ryder is with us, and Aziz Abu Sara. We will connect to all of their writings and work on our website, steinershow.org, so you can follow what they do. And I look forward to following what's going on in Israel with the two of you over the coming weeks, and maybe Monday we'll tackle this again after we see what happens over the weekend.
Thank you so much for having us. Yes, sounds good.
Thank you both so much. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are about to have another conversation, as we have had many over the years, about issues going on in the Middle East, in Israel and Palestine. There was a wonderful op-ed written in the New York Times by two people. Dimi Ryder is an Israeli journalist and blogger. He writes regularly for Plus 972 magazine, and his work has appeared in The Guardian, Foreign Policy, Haaretz, and The Jerusalem Post. And Aziz Abu Sara, who is also executive director of the Center for World Religion, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution, writes for a number of newspapers, including Al-Quds, and is also a regular contributor to Plus 972 magazine. They wrote this editorial about the movement in Israel that we've come to know in America, at least, as Israel Summer, akin to the Arab Spring, where one out of seven or six of all Israelis are in the streets. An amazing moment in our history of the world and in the history of Israel and Palestine. And Dimi and Aziz, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be on the show.
So to tell this movement that I think, Dimi, you referred to in something I read that you wrote this morning, is a J-14 is what people are calling it, right?
Yeah, they call it J-14 because the first tents were pitched on the 14th of July. The movement started with a group of young people, young professionals in Tel Aviv, who decided to protest the increasing rent prices and the lack of any rent control in their city by pitching tents on Tel Aviv Poshest Boulevard. Now, they really didn't expect anything like what followed. They tapped into a national mood of discontent about all kinds of issues, about housing prices and parenting costs, gas prices, and overall a sense of complete alienation between the Israelis and their government. So the 14 tents are now over 400 just on that boulevard. There are over 40 protest camps across the country, including in Arab towns, including mixed Arab-Jewish tents, including Jerusalem, Be'er Sheva, Haifa, major cities and smaller towns and intersections. And it just keeps growing and growing. And they managed to bring out 300,000 people onto the streets this weekend, which is completely unprecedented for any social issues protest in Israeli history.
300,000 people in a nation of what, 7 million?
Yep.
That's an astounding number. And Aziz, I wonder, as an Israeli, as a Palestinian, tell me what your thoughts were from the beginning of watching this to what it has now kind of mushroomed into.
Well, for me, I'm from Jerusalem, and for me, it's very, very exciting to see that, to see a movement in Israel that's growing this fast. And I think many Arabs and many Palestinians watch this, and for the first time, they see something different about Israel. So in many ways, it is changing stereotypes. And I believe it has to do also, and this is what many Arabs felt, it has to do with being inspired by the Arab Spring and, you know, many of the similarities between the two made Arabs appreciate this movement and Palestinians, you know, from using Facebook to get it going to some of the signs actually in the protests, things like go away in Arabic written, which appeared, signs in Arabic appeared in the protests when the 300,000 went out, or other signs comparing Netanyahu to other Arab leaders. So that brought some kind of solidarity. In the same time, many Palestinians are disappointed that it doesn't refer much to the, or at all, to the situation between the Palestinians and Israelis, to the occupation, and how part of Israel's trouble is not only the economics in Israel, but also how the occupation affects the economics in Israel.
Let me pick up on that from both your perspectives, Dimi and Aziz. I mean, this is something you two also alluded to in the piece you both wrote, your op-ed piece in the New York Times, that this protest, while unprecedented, huge, crossing religious, secular, political lines, Palestinian, Arab, Israelis, and Jewish Israelis, all part of this massive demonstration, And we'll talk about some of the nuances of these alliances taking place within that. But that is the elephant in the room, isn't it? I mean, what part do you think that plays? What part could it play in the future about in this kind of massive protest movement, or does it at all, Dimi?
Well, I mean, since I'm going to try and explain why the protests are so far skirting the occupation issue, I should first say that my position is that the occupation should end immediately or as quickly as possible. It's a profoundly immoral practice regime that has no place to be, whether it's economical or non-economical. At the same time, the protesters decided to avoid the occupation issue in the beginning because it's simply the most divisive wedge issue in Israeli politics, and because they desperately wanted to avoid being labeled as left-wing. Now, the left-wing is not exactly in its prime in Israel.
Right.
And being essentially being called a lefty is considered a smear. And if they had started by protesting against the occupation, there would still be a bunch of people in a couple of tents, and they would probably be gone after a week. However, I wouldn't say that the Palestinian issues are absent from the protest. The issues of Palestinians within Israel are very much present, and that's also an unprecedented development, that we have a consensus-based movement that enjoys a steady 87% support in every poll that's been conducted since it began, is including in its demands very, very specific demands for Palestinian citizens of Israel, including expanding the municipal borders of Palestinian towns and villages to allow for development and new construction, which is something that hasn't happened in decades, I think maybe in many towns, not since 1948, and recognizing the unrecognized Bedouin villages of the Negev. And these issues were also raised by Palestinian author Oda Bisharat, who addressed the 300,000-strong rally. Now, I think that while the occupation still remains very much the elephant in the room, I think that the protests inadvertently are beginning to challenge something even deeper than the occupation. I mean, what we have essentially right now in Israel-Palestine is a country that's controlled by one government. I mean, the PA doesn't have that much authority despite its name. In which groups of people are separated by the degree of rights they enjoy. And, of course, the most disadvantaged from that perspective are the Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza. But the logic everywhere, whether it's about the military regime and the checkpoints or discrimination in housing and in education budgets, is still about separation along ethnic cultural lines. And these lines are being challenged by the protesters. Now, they're not being challenged in some huge rallying cry that we're all the same and there should be complete and absolute brotherly love and equality. But on the ground, some alliances are beginning to take place, including between Jewish activists who are traditionally affiliated with the Likud party and Palestinian activists affiliated with the much more left-wing Hadash and Balad, and they're uniting around issues of justice, but not only issues of historical justice for Palestinians, but issues of everyday practical justice that they can find common language on with Israelis. It's it's far from enough. I think that the elephant is going to make a very loud appearance in September, but I think that the movement is challenging something very deep that's also related to the occupation.
Now, who did you say was going to make a loud appearance in September?
Sorry, the elephant in the room
will
materialize.
Yes,
very
right.
Yeah,
I think it will. And I wonder, Aziz, if what you think. I mean, the one of the things I was thinking about is you were speaking to me, and I wonder, Aziz, what you think of this is that when you watch this massive movement in Israel, 300,000 people, Palestinians living within Israel are part of this as well as Jewish Israelis. I wonder if you think two things. A, will a new language arise out of this that allows people to talk and cross issues they haven't done before? And do you think that it will have an effect at all in the consciousness of Israelis about the occupation?
I think it's hard to predict, but I think it's possible. But the belief is if a movement of people is successful in achieving one thing and pushing the government to toward more social justice in Israel and a welfare state, which is, you know, Israel was established on the promise of welfare, then people who are against the occupation gonna have some faith in their ability to actually make a difference. And maybe you'll see more and more people willing to go out to the streets and protest the occupation, which has not happened in the recent years. The biggest protest I've seen against the occupation was a few weeks ago. It was in Jerusalem, and it was somewhere between 3,000 to 5,000 people. But this, I want to say that this avoiding talking about the occupation is understandable at the moment, but I don't believe the protesters will have the ability to continue to kind of separate the occupation from these issues, because they're thrown into this discussion, whether they like it or not. The Knesset, the first thing members in the Knesset did after the protest was 40 of them signing a petition asking the Prime Minister Netanyahu to build in the settlements to solve the problem of housing. 40, that's about that third of the people in the Knesset. And that's the problem with the Israeli government at the moment, that when it thinks about how to serve Israel, how to help Israelis, their priority is thinking in the term of how can we grow settlements, not really in how can we help the Israeli public in general. There are 7 million Israelis, but 300,000 that live in the West Bank and another 200,000 in East Jerusalem get most of the attention. When you look at finances in general, you know, when 15% of the budget for building goes to the West Bank, serving 4% of the Israeli public, it shows you a priority of the government. And unless they're willing, people are eventually willing to challenge that, it'll be a problem. And Netanyahu's recent decision, or the government recent decision we've heard in the last couple of days, is building more in Har Chumah, East Jerusalem, which came in a perfect timing, kind of say, well, you need more housing. Okay, we're going to build in a settlement. Who's going to challenge that now? Even the left couldn't challenge that in Israel, because everybody's talking about we need more housing, we need more housing. So although they might have the ability now to ignore it for maybe a couple more weeks or 3 more weeks, eventually they're thrown into this conversation. And as more settlers are joining this movement and coming and staying in Tel Aviv and saying, we are for this movement, we're also social activists, the protesters are going to have to think how we're going to deal with it.
Now, Dimi, pick up from that. I mean, I wonder, I mean, because the heart of this began, as you pointed out, as many have pointed out, around the issue of housing, the cost of housing, the cost of childcare, the end of the end of the kind of social underpinning of Israeli society, as Dalia Scheinland wrote about in Plus 972 magazine. She said the latest poll, one poll she did, showed that the majority of Israelis would rather see socialism than capitalism in terms of what's going on in Israel. So I wonder how all that fits into where this might go, because it sounds like, well, let me just let you go ahead.
Yep. Well, I mean, first of all, regarding the Knesset petition about the building more houses in the occupied territories, I mean, the politicians are trying to piggyback on the protest in all kind of ways. They're not exactly met with a huge uproar of support and gratitude from the protesters. In fact, right now, the alienation between most protesters and most in case is so great that many of them don't dare make an appearance in the camp. Same goes for Netanyahu. You know, every party and every politician is going to use it and abuse it for the benefit of his own sector, of his own ideological line. It's true that the settlers have begun joining the protest, and there would be like several aspects to that. First of all, many of the settlers, despite them being one of the most privileged sectors in terms of you know, government and state benefits that they get, socioeconomically they themselves are pretty weak. They're kind of in the bottom of the middle class, spilling over into the working class section, and many of them really do feel that they also would like a better quality of life. Some of them think that they wouldn't need to live in a settlement if there was affordable housing within Israel, etc., etc. And of course, on top of that, there is a lot of lack of awareness of their status as beneficiaries and participants in an occupying regime. But in terms of the more ideological right-wing settlers, who have been joining the protest. It should be said that they were very quickly contained by the protesters. Another reason why the settlers haven't really managed to ride on the crest of this movement is because they're saying that the solution, they have a slogan saying that the solution to the housing crisis is in Judea and Samaria, or as it's known to the rest of the world, the West Bank. But the whole protest is about Israelis wanting to be able to afford where they already live. They don't want to move to the West Bank. They have even less sympathy for that than for Netanyahu's offer to move out of the big cities into a smaller town and contribute to the development of Israel's social geographical periphery. The settlers have also made another, the right-wing activists among the settlers also made the mistake of showing up at the 10th protest with very exclusionary slogans. They were calling for Tel Aviv for Jews only, saying that the reason for the housing crisis is the influx of refugees from Sudan into southern Tel Aviv neighborhoods and other slogans of that sort. And they were very quickly pointed out, again, not by any kind of like organized leadership of the protest, but by a general assembly of the protesters, that these slogans are unacceptable, that they are welcome to stay in protest and participate as much as they like, but any exclusionary signs, anything, any calls for violence or for discrimination against Arab or Africans or anybody else will not be accepted. And so far, they haven't really managed to fit in. I mean, they tried camping in Russia Boulevard a couple of times, and they were gone pretty soon. In terms of what the protesters actually want, there's a kind of a nostalgic memory of Israel before 67 that was definitely much more of a welfare state than it is today. Whether it's possible or desirable to return there, many protesters would disagree. We have to remember that this welfare state was also characterized by ethnic discrimination among Israelis. For most of the 20 years before the occupation, there was an occupation-like regime in the Galilee and in Arab cities. There were land expropriations. And overall, I think what they're trying to, what they would like to see is more of a social capitalism system, less of a socialist economy of the kind that Israel supposedly used to have.
We're talking with Dimi Ryder, who you just heard, and Aziz Abu Saro, who both wrote an op-ed piece together in the New York Times, which is where we found them. We're going to take a very brief break and come right back.